Chapter 17. Jedi are seldom public figures, and rarely risk controversy. But Jacen Solo's extraordinary record in recent weeks, leading the war on terrorism, even flying combat missions in the Corellian blockade, marks him out as a man less concerned with the esoteric spiritual preoccupations of the Jedi Order than with doing his bit for the Galactic Alliance. He's the perfect counter to those critics who demand to know what taxpayers get for their credits from the Jedi Order. But ironically, he still has almost no status within the Order itself. He doesn't even hold the rank of Master. HNE's Weak in Focus Political Commentary. The Jedi Temple, Coruscant, 2215 hours. Even the Jedi Council had its business hours. Jacen always found that amusingly unspiritual. He could enter the temple at any time, but he needed to be in the council chamber itself, and that required a little deception. It also needed a massive force effort from him, because he had to make himself invisible at the same time as shutting down his force presence and flow-walking back in time. He doubted he could hold all three elements together for long. He had to enter the chamber, listen and look into the past, and leave no trace of his visit. Jacen, back in his traditional robes again, wandered around the temple archives room, browsing the data files, until there were only a few Jedi left reading at the terminals. They would hardly notice that he had disappeared among the shelves and not walked past them again. Concentrating on his body as if it were a shell, he used the Falanasi skills he had learned to project an illusion of being nothing, of having transparency, and drew his force presence so far inside himself that he vanished to all Jedi senses. A woman lost in thought while she stared unblinking at a screen took no notice of him when he sat down next to her. Now he could walk into the council chamber itself unseen, he hoped. The temple, whose rebuilding had struck Jacen as a needlessly expensive statement of power, was now working in his favor. He had marshaled the courage to look into his grandfather's past again, and this was the place he needed to be to do that, on the site of the very chamber where Anakin Skywalker's fate had been decided. He slipped through the doors and stood within the circle. The inlaid marble floor was said to be identical to the one on which Anakin would have walked. Jacen stared at it, wondering if he might see the floor through Anakin's eyes. He had felt his emotions, and he had seen through his own mother's eyes. It might be possible to do both at once. Listen. He felt the soles of his boots become part of the marble, as if he were growing into the polished slabs like a tree. His head buzzed, snatches of conversation washed over him until, like picking out the sound of his own name in the crowded, noisy room, he heard, "Anakin." He felt as if he were breaking on a long slide down a hillside. He felt the jolt in his mind, and the sounds in his head became clear. He didn't recognize the voices, but he could easily work out who some of them were.
"So, is he the chosen one?"
"Qui-Gon believes so."
"But what do we believe?"
"Skywalker is exceptional, but he's past the age of being trained."
"But is he the chosen one?"
"If he is, then training him becomes irrelevant. He will either find his path or not."
"A logical argument you make, but direction is needed."
"Then who will train him? Who can train him? Perhaps nobody can take on the challenge."
"But if we do not train him, regret it we may."
"And none of us can take on a Padawan, and we have more pressing problems to deal with."
The last speaker was Mace Windu. Jacen recognized him from recordings, and his heart sank at how easily they had abdicated responsibility for Anakin, considering that he was the chosen one. Jacen sought parallels, more clues to where Anakin had gone astray on his path, to show him the pitfalls to avoid. This time he needed to see what had happened. He shut out the time echoes of the voices again, and slipped into a corner where he could hide if his force invisibility failed as he flow-walked into the past. The effort of sustaining all the techniques at once was making him sweat. His head pounded, and the image of the chamber blurred for a moment, but then it cleared, and Jason felt as if he had woken with a start. The council sat in their ceremonial seats, or appeared as holograms, and one of those present in the flash was Anakin Skywalker, now a young man, and a very angry one. He was standing in the center of the chamber in a black cloak, arguing with Mace Windu and Yoda.
"Allow this appointment lightly, the council does not. Disturbing is this move by Chancellor Palpatine."
"You are on this council, but we do not grant you the rank of master."
"What? How can you do this? This is outrageous. It's unfair. I'm more powerful than any of you. How can you be on the council and not be a master?"
"Take a seat, young Skywalker."
Jason watched for a few moments, and both pitied and understood Anakin, and knew that he wasn't following his path, not at all.
Poor grandfather. Gifted, exceptional, dismissed. Barely tolerated, largely untrained, abandoned. No wonder he resorted to crazed, desperate violence. Had he received the training that Jason had, if he had been able to perfect his powers and experience all uses of the Force, even those the Jedi Academy shied away from teaching, then the galaxy might have been a very different place.
"I'm the second chance. The Jedi Council dropped the ball, and they paid for it."
Jason had accepted his Sith destiny, but now he understood not only that it had to happen, but why. Everything in his life had led to this point, because Anakin Skywalker's destiny had been subverted and warped by well-meaning but blind masters, sending him off on a tangent to do a flawed Palpatine's bidding instead of realizing his own full power.
"I'm more powerful than any of you."
It was a boy's expression of anger, but it was true. And as history repeated itself, because it had no other choice, Jason was more powerful than any of them except Luke, and he was growing closer to Luke's strength by the day. When he achieved Sith mastery, he would surpass him. He hadn't yet thought how Luke and he would coexist after that point had been reached. For a brief and tempting moment, Jason considered force-walking into the future, as he had done before. But his instinct said to leave it alone for the time being. Power. Power was a vulgar personal word, shot through with ambition and petty vanity. Becoming a master was a necessary political step in achieving the ultimate order. Beyond that it had no meaning, but Jason would still seek it, purely as a tool. He could maintain the time flow and invisibility no longer. He snapped out of the past and held his presence in check long enough to leave the chamber and pause farther down the corridor to catch his breath. A maintenance worker appeared from a storeroom and stared at him, surprised.
"Good night, friend," said Jason,
and mind-rubbed the memory from the man as he left. Slave 1, Coronet City Spaceport, Corellia.
"How do you breathe in this thing?" Han grumbled.
"Try shaving in it," said Fett.
Han Solo adjusted the Mandalorian helmet with both hands. The spare armor that Fett kept stowed in Slave 1 as a backup was just what he needed to get them right up close to Sal Solo. The body plates weren't fitted, so they attached to Han's clothing without too much trouble, but the helmet was a custom job and he was struggling with it.
"I can't see," said Han.
Fett activated the HUD.
"Whoa! What is all this?"
Han put his hand on the bulkhead as if he were falling over.
"I can't balance."
"Data display and 360-degree vision."
Fett shut down most of the feeds and the blink-operated controls, so that Han saw only what he'd see with his own eyes. It would take him days to get used to the 360-degree field of view without crashing into things. And there was no point confusing him with the rest of the display that rolled and flashed constantly inside the visor. If he blinked at the wrong time, he'd either blow himself up or wipe billions off the stock exchange. He only needed to be able to see.
Never worn a helmet?
Yeah, but I don't recall stormtrooper helmets being quite this fancy inside.
That's cheapskate defense procurement for you. Try walking.
Han paced up and down the narrow galley in Slave One's cargo section, turning his head left and right. Myrta watched him with cold indifference. But Fett had come to know her well enough to realize that the news of Aelin's capture had knocked her sideways. Maybe there was a really big bounty hanging on that necklace.
"Okay, I can do this," said Han. "I can see well enough to blow his brains out.
So explain this to me. We just walk in and ask to see your cousin. Then we get him on his own, then we kill him.
Then I kill him.
I agreed to kill him, and I will. Fett didn't have time for this. You can take a shot, too, if it makes you feel better.
And he's just going to let you stroll in?
Yes. He asked for some Mandalorian assistance. I said we'd think about it.
I've thought. What assistance?
Defending Centerpoint.
But you took a contract to assassinate him, Han said.
Gedgen made me an offer, and I accepted. I didn't accept Sal Solo's. I'm a man of my word. A contract is a contract.
So he poses your Mandalorian henchman.
He'll want to see us.
How do we find our way around? It's a maze in those offices.
Already done the recce and recorded the data.
Fett projected the holoplans of the presidential offices onto the cargo bay bulkhead. The penetrating radar had built up a detailed three-dimensional walkthrough image.
Getting in is easy. Next two stages are getting him on his own, because I don't like collateral damage, and getting out again.
Can't Gedgen help you do that?
How's he going to explain a dead president?
Myrta looked up.
He'll blame it on the Alliance, because that's very handy for him.
She's good, said Han. Either way, we get out fast. I suggest we exit via this route to his bunker, which leads to this tunnel that comes out in the park.
Fett traced the illuminated transparent chart with the finger of his glove, and considered how bad a firefight might get if they were trapped in that tunnel. Myrta only had a small bag with her. That meant not much kit, not enough kit.
You want a helmet, girl?
No.
You'd better be fast, then.
Han stared at the chart, seeming more comfortable within the confines of the helmet.
Thrakken's got a bunker?
Civil Emergency Center. He's got direct access from his office.
You don't trust him either.
He has no honor, but that's irrelevant.
I don't think I'll ever understand you, Fett. You kill without blinking, and yet you're taking an awfully big risk to find a daughter who's tried to vape you.
He's all heart, really, said Myrta.
I must be, because you're still alive, said Fett.
Han eased off the helmet and took a deep breath.
And I never had you down for a double act, either.
We're not, said Fett.
But Myrta had her uses, and she never gave up. He liked that.
He needs me for ballast, Myrta said sourly.
Fett checked the charge on his blaster. The adrenaline rush of carrying out a job on the spur of the moment like this had made him forget his illness for a while, and it left him with a pleasant sense of omnipotence. The pain in his stomach and joints, a persistent tenderness that sometimes peaked into a sensation almost like toothache, was always there now, but it could still be pushed into the background without his reaching for painkillers. He wondered how long he'd be able to do that.
Nobody ever survived the Sarlacc, but I did. If you want something badly enough, push yourself hard enough, you can do anything. Even survive against all odds. Even restore an empire. Even heal a rift with your only child.
Yes, he could do anything. He was Boba Fett. He was what his father had made of him, and that was a survivor.
Oya,
said Myrta.
What's that mean?
Fett asked. Myrta checked her blaster.
Let's go hunting.
Galactic Alliance ship Ocean. Alliance Third Fleet, Corellian Exclusion Zone. Day 6 of the blockade.
Well, that's going to make life interesting for Omus, said the hologram of Admiral Neothel.
A line of vessels, some freighters, some individual warships, some starfighters, and some whose profiles didn't match anything Jason had ever seen, had formed up in line astern a Corellian cruiser, Bloodstripe, at 50 kilometers from the Alliance picket blockading Centerpoint Station. The ops room crew of Ocean watched the unmoving ranks of lights on the scanner. The commander of the Third Fleet, Admiral Macon, another Mon Cal with an unflinching approach to warfare, stood beside the hologram of Neothel with his arms folded.
"I make that one Bonnet and Cutlass class, a couple of Fondorian fighters, and that's an Otzeri freighter," said the weapons officer. "They've been on station for the past hour."
Macon turned to face the image of Neothel.
"May I have confirmation of orders, ma'am?"
"Maintain the exclusion zone and deny access to all vessels," said Neothel. "And if an Alliance vessel is fired upon or otherwise threatened, then you may engage."
"Colonel Solo," said Macon.
"Put Rogue Squadron on Alert 5.
Awaiting your orders, sir.
Let's see who blinks first this time."
Jason made his way to the hangar deck, where a row of XJ-7s stood, with canopies open and ground technicians running pre-flight checks. Jaina and Zek were leaning against a bulkhead talking in hushed voices, and Jason chose not to use his force senses to listen. Jaina greeted him with a hostile stare and a definite sense of pushing him away in the force.
"Good of you to drop in, Colonel Solo," she said.
His instant commission had really irked her.
"Who's minding the shop back at Secret Police HQ?"
Zek greeted him with a nod.
"Now, Jaina, we have a guest star. Be nice."
Jason chose not to take offense.
"Mission brief, people."
"It doesn't matter. Pass beyond it."
"Some other fleets have fronted up on behalf of Corellia, some of them civilian vessels. They're lined up, daring us to take a crack at them." "We've been watching the scanner repeater."
Zek nodded in the direction of the bulkhead, where a large holoscreen mirrored the tactical information from the ops room.
"This is going to get tricky. One wrong move, and we suck in a lot more enemies."
Jaina completed Zek's sentence, a holdover from their time as joiners.
"Do we have orders to engage?"
Jason could feel her mistrust and sorrow. It was a real weakness in a squadron if pilots had lost faith in their commander. But it wasn't his military judgment she would question. It was his morality.
"Only if fired upon or placed under serious threat." "I'm glad we're clear," said Jaina.
She picked up her helmet from the bench, lowered it into place, and fastened the chin strap.
"Are we just going to buzz them or try to drive them back?" "Right now, none of them are in the exclusion zone. If that changes, we turn them back." "I love a standoff," said Zek. "Are they letting supplies through to the shipyard orbiters yet?" "No. Total exclusion zone means total exclusion zone. Even in Corellian space. Not our problem, Zek. The legality of that is for the Senate to argue later." "Okay, time to turn and burn."
Three XJ-7s didn't constitute a major confrontation, but Jason was clear how far he would allow things to proceed. This was another game that could easily escalate. The three starfighters came up well under the line of assorted vessels and looped around to take up positions between them and the Alliance picket ships, ringing center point on the outer side. Moving to intercept across that huge curve of alloy and durasteel meant a fast dash, but that was what XJ-7s were made for. Jason watched his cockpit console display for movement. He reached out carefully in the force to test Jaina's state of mind. She was, as ever, focused on the job at hand, but a persistent ripple of hostility, there was no other word for it, tinted the slow eddies. He felt a strong shove back against him in his mind.
"Get out of my head."
He could grasp the meaning as clearly as if she could share words with him.
"Back off."
Jason wondered if Zek could sense this, too. He didn't attempt to test Zek's feelings, but he shared an emotion with both of them instead. He sent calm. They waited, silent, watching their screens. One of the Fondorian fighters eased out of the line and passed Bloodstripe. It advanced slowly toward Zek, who was holding position on Jason's starboard wing.
"Steady," said Zek.
The Fondorian slowed almost to a halt and then suddenly peeled off to one side. Zek matched its maneuver instantly and harried it for 10 kilometers at close range until it swung around and headed back to the line behind Bloodstripe. Now all the vessels pulled forward to form a line level with the Corellian cruiser.
"They're going to go for it, Zek," said Jaina.
"Yeah, I feel it."
"Here we go."
Jason said nothing. Bloodstripe didn't move, but the ships to either side of her did. They spread farther apart, and for a moment he wondered if they were simply going to try to draw Alliance ships away. But the picket ships at their back had orders to remain on station. Their laser cannons could very nearly cover the whole run of Center Point's access bays, and Jason was sure Bloodstripe's commander knew that. This was a gesture. This was provocation.
"Hold steady,"
said Jason. Then the Otzeri freighter picked up speed and came straight at them. Jason had it on visual now. It was an old ship and lightly armed to deter piracy, but it was picking up speed.
"He's coming right at you, Jaina," said Jason. "If he hasn't changed his mind to 2 kilometers, give him a reminder who's in charge here."
"I'll buzz him."
"You be careful," said Zek.
The freighter showed no signs of slowing. It was coming at the picket head-on, and its course appeared to be about to take it between the XJ-7s and within 3 clicks of one of the Alliance destroyers. The only question was when it was prudent to block its path.
"That's close enough,"
said Jaina, and edged forward to skim over the freighter's casing, nearly shaving its antennae. The freighter didn't waver.
"He needs another reminder," said Jason,
and set off after Jaina to block the freighter's path.
"Bonneton cruiser breaking on the far side,"
Zek's voice was a whisper.
"Leave that to me."
Resolute, one of the picket destroyers cut in on the shared comlink.
"Laser cannon targeted, Rogue 3, just in case he gets any ideas."
The cruiser was a legitimate target. It was an armed warship. The Otzeri freighter, though, needed more careful handling. Firing on a civilian vessel was a political risk, not a military one. Jason set a head-on course for the freighter's long panel of viewports set across the width of its nose. Jaina had looped back and was making a second pass to block the ship.
"Blank,"
said Jason. The freighter held its course.
"Go on, blank."
They were on a collision course. It wasn't high speed, but in space even a low-velocity collision could be disastrous.
"Don't play this game with me, friend," Jason said.
He could now see the figures moving on the freighter's brightly lit bridge. He was close enough to see the color of their overalls.
"Not yet."
Red, blue, a few green. Humans, all of them.
"Not yet."
30 seconds more on this course would smash him into their viewport.
"Steady."
If he didn't pull up in 20 seconds, he'd be dead. He was no longer aware of Jaina or Zek, just the rust-streaked ship with its band of white light that now filled his field of view. He became a pilot again, not a Sith lord-in-waiting or a Jedi with all the knowledge of generations, but a pilot at one with his fighter.
10 seconds.
Jason surrendered himself to instinct. He jerked the controls, and the XJ-7 climbed high and fast just as the freighter made a last-second dip below the plane of collision. Jason knew he had missed the hull by meters. When he reached the top of his climb, he looked down and saw that the freighter's aft ports had opened. Small laser cannons were trained on him. Not all ships had their armament mounted forward. Freighters expected sometimes to be chased in pirate-infested space lanes.
"Got you," said Jaina. "Jason, I'm targeting their cannons."
There was a staccato exchange of white and blue streams of fire beneath Jason as he arced down into a dive and came up behind Jaina. The freighter fired again, and then Jaina was clear of the stream and coming about for a second time. Jason watched one cannon mounting shatter and break into a shower of shimmering particles, and then the other. The freighter slowed and began to turn. Jason sent a one-word message to Jaina in the Force.
"Fire!"
He felt her resist him. He switched his comm link to Jaina's channel alone.
"Finish it, Jaina! I've disabled both aft cannons. He's heading back.
He opened fire. Do it!"
"Jason, the ship's damaged, and he's retreating. I can't continue the attack. You know the rules of engagement. I won't do it. It's a civilian vessel, and right now he isn't presenting a threat."
"That's an order."
"It's outside the ROE."
"It's legitimate. I repeat, take him out."
"Colonel Solo, I'm refusing that order."
Jaina cut her comm link and swung back to the picket line. Jason seethed. She was crazy. Civilian or not, the freighter had opened fire. Retreating or not, it still had functioning cannons. It was a clear threat. Jason lined up the icons on his console and sent a spread of 5 torpedoes into the freighter.
"Jason, what the—"
That was all Jason heard from Zek. A ball of gold light plumed from the starboard side of the freighter's hull. Then another and another. And suddenly, half its flank was in fragments and hitting ships alongside. The line flanking Bloodstripe broke and scattered. On his screen, Jason saw the pinpoint images of small lifeboat ships disgorging from the cruiser to go to the freighter's aid. Half of the ship had blown away.
"Rogue Squadron, bang out now!"
Resolute's commander cut in.
"We're opening fire. Get out of there."
Jason dropped immediately under Resolute's arc of fire and headed back to Ocean, picking up Zek and Jaina as he went. He could feel Jaina's fury as she trailed him in silence. Zek opened the comlink.
"Anyone want to tell me what happened back there? Jaina, why did you break off?"
Jason answered for her.
"Colonel Solo refused a direct order," he said carefully.
It broke his heart, but he had no choice.
"My sister. I've really lost her now. Why won't she see what has to be done?"
"She's now suspended from duty."
Presidential Offices, Coronet Corellia, 1830 hours.
"Do take a seat," said Thrakken Sal Solo. "I wasn't expecting to see you back so soon."
The doors to the office were open, and a couple of Sal Solo's staff sat at desks in the adjoining room. Fett perched on the edge of one of the fine brocade chairs and motioned to Han to sit down. Myrta simply stood to one side, arms folded. Sal Solo didn't seem to expect to be introduced to Fett's new associate. He'd meet him soon enough.
"Did you have second thoughts?" asked Sal Solo.
"Just seeking clarification,"
Fett said. He noted the position of the door that led to the emergency bunker.
"Can we discuss this in private?"
"How private?"
"Is this room soundproofed?"
"Yes."
"Then shut the doors and give your staff the rest of the evening off."
For a man like Sal Solo, it wasn't an unusual request. Fett was counting on it. He hadn't been paid to silence any bystanders. The doors closed, and they were as alone with Sal Solo as they were ever likely to be. There was a panel of comlinks on the desk. Fett was pretty sure one of them would be a priority button to summon help. He was also sure that Sal Solo carried more than one blaster.
"Don't make a hash of this, Solo. Clean shot.
I should never have let you tag along, but you're my ticket to my daughter now.
Tell me again what you have in mind for Center Point.
His HUD showed nobody in adjoining offices. Beyond two rooms, the penetrating radar became less efficient.
Why will I give anything to see Aelin now, after 50 years? Amazing, the power that mortality has over your mind.
He rested his hand on his blaster rifle. He always carried it rather than sling it across his shoulder. Sal Solo seemed unperturbed by it. Myrta didn't take her eyes off him. Han was silent but visibly tense. Fett could see it in his shoulders.
Once Corellian forces breach the blockade, we can resupply the station with technical equipment and reactivate it. We'd hope to position your men inside to stop further sabotage. It's a huge station to make intruder-proof. Okay, watch me carefully. Like I said, 1,000,000 credits per man per month.
Fett counted the seconds. Han twitched.
Cheaper than an army, I suppose, Thraken said at last.
100 Mandalorians is an army, said Fett.
And then Han leapt from the edge of his seat and slammed across Sal Solo's desk, knocking him flat into the wall and upending his chair. Sal Solo pulled a holdout blaster from his jacket while they struggled, and Han headbutted him. The blaster went flying.
"You moron, you blew it!"
Han pulled off his helmet with one hand and had his cousin by the throat.
"You scum!"
Fett launched himself across the desk and pinned Sal Solo down.
"Just do it, Solo," he snapped. "Kill him, or I will. It's not sport."
Myrta covered the doors with her blaster. At least the girl knew what she was doing.
"I've waited years for this, Fett."
"Make it fast, then."
Fett assumed Han wanted to make his cousin suffer before he killed him, which was sloppy, but then family feuds were always too emotionally charged.
"Remember what you agreed."
Han had a stranglehold on Sal Solo's throat. The man's eyes bulged.
"Never again, you scumbag!"
He dug his fingers into the skin.
"You never mess with me or my family again."
Sal Solo found a defiant, strangled voice.
"You think the bounty hunter I decoyed you all with on Coruscant is the only one hunting you?"
"What do you mean?"
Fett grabbed Han's wrist to stop him choking Sal Solo before he answered.
"What decoy?"
"I tipped them off about her. Too busy following her to worry about the others. They're coming, Han, and you don't know how many. You'll never be able to sleep soundly again."
"Aelin. You set up Aelin. You used my little girl."
"Back off, Solo.
He's mine,"
said Fett, and held the blaster to Sal Solo's head.
"No, he's mine,"
said Myrta, and rolled across the desk to fire 3 bolts into Sal Solo's forehead. It was a split second of total silence, and then 2 seconds of chaos. Han was cursing that he'd been cheated. Fett put 2 rounds into Sal Solo to be sure he'd finished him.
"And that's for Aelin, too." "You should learn to shoot first, Solo," said Fett. "Now get down that passage fast. Run for it."
"But I wanted to take him, for all he's done to me."
"Go on, then. Put a few more through him. Have your vengeance. Then shut up and get moving."
The room might have been soundproofed, but the sound of blaster fire could penetrate a long way. Fett wasn't sure Han could do it. But Sal Solo was dead already, and Han no longer had to face shooting him in cold blood. At last he fired. Fett grabbed him and shoved him through the door to the passage as Myrta retrieved the spare helmet. She was a smart kid, even if she had taken a shot she shouldn't have. They ran down a single flight of steps and into a long passage lit by yellow emergency lamps. Fett's helmet sensors picked up movement 2 rooms above, running feet. Someone was coming. He took the full set of security blades out of his pocket and set their interference pattern to block all comlinks except his own. This wasn't the time to let anyone call for backup. Then he shoved Han ahead of him and forced him to run. The fool was still staring back at his cousin's body.
"Now my side of the bargain, Solo,"
Fett panted as they ran.
My daughter. I have to see my daughter.